It's E3 2013, and you're listening to a very special episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast recorded here in Los Angeles. We've gone hands-on with both the next-gen consoles, the Xbox One and PlayStation 4. We've played the games going on sale when the consoles launch later this year, and we've met the people making both the games and the consoles to answer the most important questions about them. On this special program, I'm going to be talking to several fellow games journalists and industry experts to answer the big questions. Is next-gen gaming worth the excitement? Are the games that much richer than their current-gen equivalents? Has Sony or Microsoft got the better offering? And what should you be aware of before deciding on the console and the games you'll invest in first? I'm Nate Langson, and all that and a lot more is coming up on this Wired.co.uk podcast E3 special. Welcome to the Wired.co.uk podcast E3 special. In this first half of the show, it's all about the headlines, the announcements, and the top stories. My guest to discuss the hottest topics from this year's show is video games journalist Guy Cocker. Guy, welcome to the show. Now, we've been at E3 now for about 4 days, 3 or 4 days, I think. Mm-hmm. I want to start off by talking about one of the most controversial parts of the show, I think, which was Sony's announcement that the PlayStation 4 was going to undercut the cost of the Xbox One by about £80 when it's released later this year. And also, of course, that it's not going to restrict the resale of games versus Microsoft, which is also going to require online activation every 24 hours. Mm. So let's just put this out there. Did Sony win E3 with this?
Yeah, in most people's eyes that I've spoken to, and I think in mine as well, my own opinion is that Sony had a great E3. Against all odds, I think most people going into E3 thought that Microsoft was going to bring the big games, and they certainly did. I don't think they had an awful E3. I just think that Sony really, they had an open goal, and they really just took advantage of the fact that it's not even that Microsoft have this thing where I think the reality of the situation, when Xbox One launches, I don't think there's going to be a massive problem around DRM. There may be a couple of publishers that say, you know what, we are going to lock games to consoles or to accounts. Could be Activision, could be EA, but Microsoft's not going to do it. It's just the confusion of the whole thing, and it's a huge mental block for a lot of gamers who, whether they swap games or sell games on eBay or whatever, whether they actually do that or not, they hate the idea of being locked out or not having that option to do that. It's a, it's a fundamental, it's a loss of their rights, I think, in a lot of people's eyes.
I agree. And I think that what becomes quite clear is that, particularly with Microsoft's focus on entertainment as well, the PlayStation feels a bit more like the gamer's console, at least for present day gamers. Mm. We're going to hear later from Microsoft. I'm putting some questions to the European boss about this issue. We're going to hear from him in a bit. But it does feel to me that if you are buying one of these two consoles before the end of the year, that at least on day one, the PlayStation probably represents better financial value for someone who can only afford one console, a couple of games.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people that are buying both, but yeah, I totally agree. PlayStation 4. I mean, for me personally, if I was going to buy one right now, it would be PlayStation 4.
Microsoft requires that the Xbox One is able to connect to the internet at least once every 24 hours, if it's your own console, in order to keep playing games, even if they're single player offline games. Mm. And the reason this caused such a controversy is that, of course, you don't want to have to check in all the time, and Sony came out and said we do not require this at all, but Microsoft is basically saying with this you can go to your friend's house and you can just log into your account and your entire game library is there. Mm. If your Xbox breaks, let's say you get a new one, your library's there, your game's there, your saves are there. Mm. Everything's there. Now that does seem like a much more, I don't want to say futuristic proposition, but it does feel more like more resilient, if you like, to how we're moving towards cloud-based services outside of gaming as well as inside gaming. But that's a hard thing to market.
It is, yeah, without people trying. It's like iTunes. A lot of people initially freaked out about the fact that iTunes would restrict you to, only being able to play your music on 5 different devices. but it quickly becomes the norm and people accept it. So when Xbox One comes out, I expect it to become the same. You know, I think people will be okay with it. I'm okay with the idea of, and I'm a bad example because, you know, I'm a games journalist, so I get a lot of stuff, you know, games sent to me, so I don't buy that many. But basically what I'm saying is I'm quite happy with the fact that I don't own Call of Duty, for example, that I kind of essentially lease it. I don't think I'm going to want to play that game in like 10, 15 years' time.
I completely agree. And I think similar with how we're seeing, say, music shift from ownership, buying CDs, to services like Spotify, rental, you're paying for access rather than ownership. That line's being blurred, I think, with the consoles. But I think it does become an issue where we're in an era where games are still costing £50 to buy. And, you know, it's all well and good if you're someone with a very high salary or huge household income and you can afford to buy game after game after game for £50. But, you know, a lot of kids, you know, or, you know, the average guy in the street maybe just have a Saturday job. He goes out, he buys his Call of Duty, his Killzone, whatever, plays through it, gets bored. They need to be able to take that game into game or send it off to Amazon, get the credit to fund the next game because the games are so expensive.
Yeah, it's what I would describe it as.
Which can't happen on the Xbox One, understand it right now.
Right now, yeah. Again, it's very, very confusing. And we should say, actually, in the interest of balance, that PlayStation has said that they won't require you to have any online connection or that they won't be putting in DRM measures. But they have said that there is an option for third-party publishers to have that option, that they can have... God, I'm struggling to describe it myself here. But they can have DRM on there if they want to. I don't think the publishers will. But, yeah, it's a very interesting one. We'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. But like you say, a lot of people... Moving back like 5 years, what we had was a system where there would be, you know, online codes. EA would put an online code in there that meant you had to put in a code to activate the online multiplayer. And that was so that essentially you wouldn't trade the game in or sell it. And now this is just a logical conclusion of that, where if it's locked to an account, they don't have to worry about codes or anything else. They know that you can't sell it on. And I think a lot of publishers would really like that. They want you to buy one copy, keep it forever, and then not sell it on. And that's the ideal for a lot of publishers like EA and Activision.
Let's talk about the games. Obviously, this is the big focus of E3. The consoles, obviously, are key here. But really, we're here to see the new games. What do they look like? We've now both had a chance to get hands-on with the PlayStation 4, with the Xbox One. We've played some of the next-gen games that are coming out, or we've seen them played to us and had walkthroughs. What is your highlight? What do you think?
I'm going to be incredibly predictable. I mean, this is a gamer show, so it is the games that are here that are exciting are the likes of Destiny, which is a new game from Bungie, the makers of Halo.
Yep.
I think that probably would just about win gamer show. We haven't... crucially not played it. I've just got so much belief in Bungie and having seen the level of polish. What I describe it as is seeing Destiny is seeing a game that goes beyond just being a game. It's such a beautifully realized world and universe. It's just incredible. When you go and see other games at this show, they look like video games in the worst way possible. They look, you know, buggy, like seeing something like Dead Rising. You know, dodgy frame rate, same sort of gameplay as we've seen before. Whereas Destiny is I think it's going to be really, really exciting. I think that from having seen other games, The Division, which is actually a Tom Clancy game, although they seem to be playing that fact down, that's from Ubisoft. That's a game that looks a little bit like The Last of Us, but online. Mirror's Edge 2 went down very, very well, and I think it's an interesting one because Mirror's Edge was a much loved but not actually very well reviewed original game, but it's just been so long in the making, the Mirror's Edge 2. And The Witcher 3 as well, I thought was very, very good. But these are all games that, you know, we've kind of seen before. What I really want to see, and what I haven't had a chance to see at this point, is those interesting indie titles. I feel like at E3, there's a lot of big noise being made, and, you know, the big games are out there, and they're all very exciting and shiny and graphically intense and amazing. But actually, I'm more interested in the little things and what the little guys are going to do with the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One.
Well, later on in the show, we're going to be talking to someone about indie games and the game Octodad, the octopus in a wedding tux is going to come up. So we'll come back to the indies later on in the show.
That was on the Xbox event, and it seemed so out of place, but also amazingly awesome. It was
Not like Octodad. It's great for me. There are a couple of highlights. I think the best looking game I've seen seen so far is Rise, which is based in the is it Roman invasion?
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
Roman-based game. Yeah. It's actually been around in various forms since 2011, but it's sort of been remade effectively for next gen. I think probably the best looking game, and
so from a technical perspective.
From a technical perspective, yeah. And also, I was very, very excited because I'm basically a Japanese gaming obsessive to see Final Fantasy 15 was announced.
Yeah, it wasn't very clear to me in the Sony press conference. It was 13. Sorry, it was Versus. And now it's 15, so it's changed its name, and obviously it's being released.
It was originally announced in 2006, and it was part of the kind of almost like a 7 or 8 year cycle of Final Fantasy games under a specific banner. Mm. It got delayed, they moved it to next gen, and now they've spun it out of the 13 series, it's now Final Fantasy 15. It's going to be the next gen Final Fantasy game. I've seen it played, it looks tremendously good. It looks very, very good.
What about Kingdom Hearts?
Not interested in cartoon games.
Really? That got a massive reaction in the Sony press.
Not from me, no.
I'm sorry, I feel like I've offended you.
No, it's just, it's not quite... it's not quite what
it's not quite Final Fantasy, I know, I get that. Yeah.
But let's talk a bit about next gen. We've seen next gen games. I mean, let's just cut to the chase. What does next gen look like? I think it looks quite good.
Yeah.
But then so did current gen when it first came out, and now the games that we see on current gen make the original releases look like pants.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an element of developers getting to use the hardware over five... What are we at now with Xbox? I think like 7 years.
Yeah, 2005 we saw the first titles.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years. So developers, when they get to use the system for a long time, and the Xbox is an old machine, but games on it look great still. You know, Gears of War, fantastic looking game. But I'd say... I'd actually kind of disagree, maybe a little bit. I remember seeing... on the Xbox, the Xbox 360, when that launched, I think we were maybe on CNET at the time, it was Project Gotham looked absolutely stunning in HD, and that was a big jump. You know, the previous generation was SD, the next generation was HD. Maybe we'll see the equivalent leap. The new consoles do support 4K resolution, maybe we'll see that. I know there's not a lot of 4K TVs out there at the moment, but there is that. It does. Xbox One and PlayStation 4 do lack that certain wow factor. Games look beautiful, they look stunning, but there's a little bit of maybe just higher resolution textures rather than a complete like wow overhaul on the next gen.
I was talking to one of the producers of Rise, actually, and he was saying to me that in one of the scenes that was being demoed in engine, real-time rendering, I got a chance to actually play the game, was a building, a kind of a castle-like building in the distance. It was a huge, huge castle. A catapult fired this giant meteorite-type thing into it, smashed it all down, it burst into flames, there was smoke billowing out. And he said it takes as much RAM to have that smoke being rendered in real time as the entire Xbox 360 had.
Right, okay.
He said that there was as much information going into rendering a single eyeball of the main character as the previous generation had for the entire character's model.
Right.
So that's what we're dealing with in terms of processing power potential. For everyone else that we're going to hear from later on in the program, I'm going to ask two questions, and we've sort of touched upon these anyway, but I just want to get the nutshell version of this. The first of these two questions is, number one takeaway highlight of the show.
Destiny, although some can I have a couple of notable highlights or
no?
Okay.
you have one console you can recommend.
I think PlayStation 4. Although Wii U got a really hard time of it because they did have a rubbish press conference. But if you go over and play those games, Nintendo's dependable. They make great games, and the stuff that's coming is great. It's just it's not coming to 2014. Excuse me. So yeah, some way off. I don't think they had a great show, but great games over there.
Guy Cocker, thank you. Joining me now, Jonathan Strickland, host of Tech Stuff and Forward Thinking. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, one of the things we talked about before recording was the focus on indie gaming at E3 this year. What is your perception of how independent developers are being treated on modern, well, on next-gen consoles?
Well, I think I actually spoke to some of the leaders at Indiecade, and they represent a lot of different independent developers who are really trying to innovate in interesting ways and give us games that we've never even imagined before. And they were telling me that Sony in particular has been really supportive, and that Sony is looking at independent developers as a way of appealing to a broad range of players who might be getting tired of that first-person shooter where you're killing the zombies for the 400th time. Don't get me wrong, I loves me some zombies, but a little variety is nice.
Yeah, and there was a lot of controversy, or at least a bit of controversy, about the presents that were given to AAA titles like the Call of Duties, the Dead Rising, the Forza 5, things like that, at Sony and Microsoft's keynotes, and that the indies kind of just got a token mention. I mean, is that...
I think that that's pretty fair. But then those press events are made to make the biggest impact possible. So you know that they're going to come out with the titles that everyone is familiar with. I mean, if they just did, or even if one-third of their presentation was all on just these tiny independent titles, everyone would be up in arms saying, where's my Halo? Where's my Metal Gear Solid? You know, so they do have to balance it out. I can see why in the big press events they don't necessarily push it so hard, but we are seeing a pretty good presence here on the show floor at E3.
Now, you played a few of these indie titles, and one that stood out is one that I saw in I think it was Microsoft's keynote. Mm-hmm. Octodad
is possibly, well, it has my favorite premise of any game that's on the floor right now. The premise is you play an octopus who is posing as a human being, but it's an octopus. It's got these long tentacles. The tentacles are shoved through various pieces of human clothing, and your goal is to pose as a human and not let anyone know that you're actually an octopus. Keeping in mind that the game's physics engine takes into account that you do not have bones, so you just flop around from place to place, and you use the buttons on the PS4 controller, although it's going to be available for desktop computers as well and laptop computers. But use the buttons on the PS4 controller to control the various tentacles, so that you have to coordinate leg and arm motions so that you look as least like an octopus in clothes as possible.
I'm asking everyone this at the end of our chats on the show this week. If you had to pick one highlight, what would the highlight be?
Gosh, one highlight. All right, I think the highlight for me is I actually got hands-on time with the Oculus Rift, and that was something that I'd been looking forward to. I missed it when it was at CES. I've been kicking myself ever since. I even thought about getting a developer kit, despite the fact that I could never develop a game for it. So I finally got a chance to play with it, and this headset is pretty incredible. Even with simple graphics, the sense of depth that you get is very convincing, and it's, you know, it's lightweight, and it just works. So that's got my thumbs up right there.
And if you had to recommend to someone at this point, based on just what we know
Sony.
So far, Sony.
I already know where you're going. Yeah, I mean, I am an Xbox fanboy. I love my Xbox. I've got an Xbox 360 and a PS3, and I play the Xbox 360 10 times more often than I do the PS3. All that being said, Sony listened to the consumers. Sony gave the consumers what they wanted, and they're doing it at $100 cheaper than the Xbox. Dollars is what we in America use for currency.
Yeah, it's about £80 cheaper, the PS3 in the UK versus the Xbox One.
So, I mean, it's the PS4, you mean.
The PS4.
But yeah, all of those things, when you take it into account, it makes a really powerful story. And even the biggest fanboy in the world, like me, can't deny that. So before I came into the show, I said, I'm just going to get an Xbox One. There's no way I'm going to get a PlayStation 4. By the time the press conference was over with Sony, I said, nope, that's not true. I will definitely be getting a PS4 and probably getting an Xbox One.
More of these views on tech stuff and forward thinking. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Nate.
One of the biggest surprises from E3 2013 was that Sony's PlayStation 4 will undercut the Xbox One by £80 at launch. Not only that, but unlike the Xbox, it won't require gamers be connected to the internet to authenticate the games they own. Rather than just discuss amongst ourselves the reasons for Microsoft's stricter approach to next-gen games ownership, I met up with the console's European boss, Chris Lewis, and put the harder questions to him directly. I'm going to start with something. I've got to start with a tough one here. Let's talk about price. £429, quite a lot for a console, fair bit more than the PS4. What would you say is the premium that the consumer is getting for that price difference?
For me, it's about the portfolio, the fact you've got Kinect in there, the new completely, you know, evolving Kinect technology that I think you may have seen at the unveil. What that offers in terms of gameplay enrichment, it's that portfolio of goodness that I think creates this value. And I think we represent fantastic value for money.
Sony's come out with a very strong message about not requiring online authentication, made a big deal of it in their keynote, and also allowing used games and resale. It seems like Microsoft's approach is a little stricter on the consumer. How would you respond to that?
I think we offer way more choice in terms of, you know, the whole library, the digital library that's available, infinitely accessible from any Xbox One, you know, the family access, all of those, all of that digital flexibility that we offer through our approach, I think offers consumers wonderful choice and a variety and richness of access that nobody else can offer.
But I'm right in thinking that if I took my Xbox One, for example, to my parents at Christmas, where I don't have internet access, I'm only going to be able to play my game for the first day I'm visiting.
Well, you can't. You're saying your parents don't have internet at all?
Yeah.
Well, I think
I'm saying theoretically.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, you're right. You have the 20. You have the once in the 24-hour authentication. You can use your mobile phone to achieve that, for example, as you may have heard from us. But you know, we're confident that the vast majority of our consumers are connected. They are hungry for what that connection experience offers them, the richness, the power of the cloud. I mean, you saw some of the gameplay enhancements yesterday on stage in terms of what that means around Forza Motorsport and other games. And I think our consumers are craving for more and more of that connected richness. And I think we are future-proof in that regard. And I love the choices that we're offering our consumers as a result.
Next-gen gaming is not all about games. The Xbox and PlayStation are media platforms. They exist for TV, movies, social interactions, and gaming even when you're not at home on the console itself. I caught up with games journalist Matt Cammon to discuss how this affects the way we'll be gaming over the next few years.
There's quite a few games coming out that are doing tie-ins with TV in various different interactive ways. Quantum Break, as I understand it, is it's effectively a choose-your-own-adventure for the TV show. You'll get the full season of the show on the disc with the game, or packaged with the game, and your actions playing Quantum Break affect the episodes as you then watch them. And I guess maybe they'll be played out, like you'll get to a chapter and they'll effectively be a glorified cutscene. But what plays out in the show is dependent on what you've achieved in the game. You've got other games like Defiance, which is already out, which is supposedly linking the community's actions playing Defiance, which is a shooter, with the story of the sci-fi TV show. And another one was Rabbids Invasion, which is aiming much younger. It's a kid's show, and that's going to be kind of like a real-time interaction, so you know, kids will kind of make shooting actions at the screen and it'll help shoot off enemies in the game. It kind of builds a little score. So it seems like there's a lot of companies putting their feet in the water for the first time and figuring out how they can get TV and games to interact.
Yeah, it seems like one of the big trends actually is that these are not just games consoles anymore. Like,
yeah, I think that's already been the case for a while, and we're just seeing the new step. I mean, at home I use my PS3 and my Xbox as much for watching Netflix or Blu-rays or DVDs as I do for playing games. You know, we've already got to the point where you've got one box or a couple of boxes under the TV, and they're doing the entirety of your media service. So what we're really just seeing is the next step in that, of how publishers and developers and content creators are kind of starting to merge the different types of content onto the device.
Let's talk a bit about second screens. Now, we've seen things like Microsoft's Smart Glass. We've seen apps that kind of tie into games. You identified this as a real trend and something that we're probably going to see a lot more of. Like, what's your take on that? Is a second screen essential now for gaming?
I'm actually quite skeptical of it. I think a lot of the time it's going to be interruptive. You're going to, you know, pause the game to fiddle with what's on the app. It's going to come down, as most things with games do, to how developers integrate it into the game. If it's so I was looking at Fable Anniversary earlier, and it, effectively you could prop up your tablet and it works as a detached map, and you can kind of tap and see, I will, in this treasure chest, if I get there, it'll have this armor or this item in it.
I think we saw that with Forza 4 possibly as well. I think there might have been a map Forza 4 you could use on smart glass.
Yeah, and you've got customization options that you can do when you're away from the screen. I think that's where second screen will be useful, when you're on a train, on a flight, or whatever. You can fiddle with stuff, sync it to your cloud or your account, and then when you get home, your car customization is ready to play. Stuff where you're using it in the middle of gaming, again, it's going to be interruptive if it's not. If it is something that you have to go, oh, I'm going to stop playing it, and now I'm going to pick up my tablet, and then I'm going to fiddle with this. That's not really part of the experience.
Mm. There was an example we saw with Dead Rising 3, new game on the Xbox One, where you can sort of get on top of a building and then use the Smart Glass app to order a rain strike, an airstrike of bombs and missiles and things down on hordes of zombies, which seems like something that could be very easily accomplished on a controller, or even by calling out airstrike, for example, on Kinect. We've seen it done quite effectively in with Rise, the new another Xbox game. It strikes me as it could be a novelty.
Yeah, definitely. The one really good example I've seen of it so far this E3 is the new Tom Clancy game from Ubisoft, where the person playing on the tablet is a separate character in the game. They're playing a drone fighter, and you can effectively put out buffs or debuffs or target enemies for the people who are playing online or in the room with the controller.
Now that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's giving a dedicated role to the person using the tablet, and it's quite a clever way of doing it and integrating it.
Last couple of questions. I've been asking this to everyone that we've spoken to today. Highlight of the show for you, one takeaway, brilliant game or product.
Mirror's Edge 2. I've been waiting for that game for however many years it's been since the first one. I adored it when it came out. I pretty much joined in with the typical American hollering when EA pulled it out right at the end. So very excited for that. I just hope they don't drop the ball.
And a very obvious final question, PS4 or Xbox One?
Based on what we know so far, I'm probably going to have to lean towards PS4.
Interesting. Matt, thanks ever so much.
No problem.
In our last segment of this E3 special, we take a step back and look at the convention as a whole. As gaming has evolved, so too has the way in which we're introduced to games to begin with. Do we even need a games convention anymore? Plus, we have one final wrap-up discussion about the Xbox One versus the PlayStation 4. Joining me now, Rick Henderson, news and features editor for Pocket Lint. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been an interesting show so far, and one of the things that strikes me about you is that you're in a great position to talk about the evolution of E3, because I think the first one you came to was about 1980.
For I am a very old man. It wasn't 1980, it was 1997, but it was actually the very first ever E3, and it was in Atlanta. And it was much bigger convention at that time, possibly because you had Sega still in the game, you had a fair few manufacturers, but there weren't so many just big publishers. There's an awful lot of smaller publishers as well. Obviously today, it's all dominated by quite large publishers who take up enormous amount of floor space and have a lot of games, but there's not possibly as much variety. I don't know. It's hard to think back and compare because it's a very different market.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I mean, obviously we've been following the games industry for quite a long time. You've been following it for a lot longer than I have. I mean, how is the general sort of feeling of a show like E3? How has it changed?
The feeling I get from certainly now in comparison is it's a lot more professional. It's a bigger, more professional network of industry-based companies. Just talking to vice presidents. I mean, people weren't even called vice president back then. You know, it was very easy to set up yourself as a software publisher out of your bedroom when I first started. So just looking at it now, it's almost like being at the Cannes Film Festival in the fact that these are big studios and they're pushing forward, pushing their products, rather than surreptitious meetings in cafes and bars.
Do you think the format of the show needs to adapt? Do you think it needs to be different? I mean, we're queuing for hours, some, or not hours, but a long time. Some of these queues for games are...
I think that, to be honest, I think that's just a product of the popularity of gaming. I think back then there were less people interested in, and certainly, I mean, let's not forget, we didn't really have the internet, which sounds awful to some people, but there was no such thing as a blogger. And so it was only media outlets and magazines being the journalists at these events, and then it was the retailers on top of that. And so there were the amount of media there was very, very small, and we all knew each other, and that's the other thing. Now it's massive. It's a global industry. Anybody has a voice online, and everybody has an opinion. And I think the reason why we queue so long is because there's so many other people interested and want to write about these products and want to see these products, which is great for the companies because they spend hundreds of millions of pounds on these products. So whereas back then you wouldn't have got anywhere near that, probably hundreds of thousands of pounds rather than millions.
Let's talk about money. You are of the mindset, I believe, that the Xbox here is the better console.
Absolutely. The reason why I say that isn't it's possibly the way that Sony has presented its PlayStation 4. And everybody has gotten really excited about the fact that it's £350. And yes, that's great. I mean, it's great that they've come in at a very much of a lower price point than Microsoft. However, it's about value for money. And if you're going to present... Sony has had two presentations so far, and at each presentation, it's only really pushed forward the games message. And not only that, but the games themselves seem to be exactly the same games.
Does that not make the proposition more clearer for the consumer, though? If you just want games, you get a PlayStation. If you are into movies and entertainment, you might prefer to get an Xbox.
But yeah, I think it probably does, but £350 just for a games machine is a lot of money. Whereas it's actually about value for money. If you think of £430 for something that does everything, all of a sudden you're not looking at such a massive price disparity. Because what you're thinking is, this machine, I'm going to buy it, the entire family are going to get use out of this. Now, it's what drives a lot of people to buy an iPad. And an iPad is a very expensive piece of kit, anywhere up to £700. Yet they buy it because they know that the whole family will enjoy that experience. They've got entertainment on it, they've got gaming, they can word process, they can do all these amazing things. And the fact that Sony hasn't said these things, to me, is telling, because Microsoft has. And Microsoft has come out and it's set its stall, and in its unveiling event it said, this is an entertainment machine, it will really run your entertainment. We don't quite know how. We haven't really got that message across yet, but we know that it's going to have a HDMI input, and we know that we can watch telly through it. Plus, they had a very good, strong games message in their press conference here. So, it just feels like it does everything rather than just gaming. And although I am a hardcore gamer, I don't want a big box in front of my telly that can only do one purpose.
I've been asking everyone on the show so far, if you had to pick Sony or Microsoft, which would you go for? I'm pretty sure you're picking Microsoft at this point, based on that.
I keep saying this, but to be honest, I think they will, just like they do already, they will both happily coexist. And I will happily go out and spend my money on both. But I would use them for very different reasons.
Yes, I agree.
And but the first, if you were to ask me which one I will be investing in this year, it will be Xbox.
And very last question, one highlight from the show. If you had to pick one thing, what's the standout thing that you've seen?
It's actually it's a game, and Ubisoft did it last year with Watch Dogs, and they've done it again, it seems, this year with Tom Clancy's The Division. The reason why it stands out to me more than any other game here is not because it's got guns and it's shooty and it's open world. Open world seems to be the trend. Everybody seems to have an open world game. It's none of those things. It's the fact that it uses a tablet device as a second gamer experience that works beautifully with this next gen. I think it was where it was run off a PC, but the idea was it was an Xbox One game, and that you can actually control a separate form of the game but interact with the players within the game through a tablet device. And that's why The Division is my game of the show.
And you've got a write-up for that on Pocket Lens?
Yes,
PocketLens.com. Rick Henderson, thanks ever so much.
All right, thank you.
That was the Wired.co.uk podcast E3 special. You can read about everything we've discussed on the programme today by visiting wired.co.uk/E3 2013. Thank you once again to my guests this week, Guy Cocker, Jonathan Strickland, Matt Cameron, Rick Henderson, and Microsoft's Chris Lewis. I'm Nate Langson, and I'll see you back on the regular Wired.co.uk podcast next time.